Yeah, Million Dollar Baby.
Million Dollar Baby, where she was, she hit her head when she was boxing. And
yeah.
He thought that, and at the end, he kills her and euthanizes her.
Yeah.
And she begs for it.
Yeah. So if you know about Million Dollar Baby, I thought it was going to be a boxing movie.
Yeah.
Like, oh, great, boxing movie. Then all of a sudden it became a, you know, this boxing prodigy breaks her neck and she's quadriplegic and she has no real purpose for living anymore. And so she begs her surrogate dad, the boxing coach, to take her life, and he does. You guys ever seen another movie that kind of centers around euthanasia?
Looks Like Hills or Me Before You.
Me Before You. Yeah, do you guys know the plot of that one?
Which one?
Me Before You. It's one where you have this studly, wealthy British man who is an athlete, does extreme sports, is engaged to a beautiful woman, and then he gets into a car accident and he's a quadriplegic. And so the whole thing is about this friendship he develops with his caretaker, and at the very end he kills himself, and that's he goes, I think, to Switzerland or someplace like that to be euthanized. So what's really interesting is that both of these movies is portrayed as a good and noble thing, right? There's not that many movies out there that kind of give you the other perspective. But why is euthanasia so attractive and so compelling to so many people?
It's seen as like a mercy death.
Yeah. Yeah, it's merciful.
It ends suffering.
It ends suffering. Yeah, Liana?
Well, like, looking at it from like the capital punishment side, like, they see it as like a way of justice.
Okay. As justice in what sense?
Like serial killers on death row, they see it as like a way to like just like for justice for them, but also like ending it so that person can't hurt more people.
Okay. And that might be a little bit, we're going to get into capital punishment in the future, so that's a little bit different.
Oh, gotcha.
Because euthanasia is the choice, the person decides that he or she wants to end their life and wants to do it in a painless process. And in many cases, they're not able to do it themselves, and so the doctors intervene and do it in a very pain-free way, theoretically, right?
So the medical community doesn't like it being called euthanasia. It's always, you get corrected, it's called assisted suicide.
Assisted suicide. Why don't they like, that seems
because
even worse.
Associated with animals. It's so closely associated with the animal world that, I mean, if you're talking to a doctor, they'll correct you if you use the word euthanasia.
Okay, assisted suicide. So I'm not the one doing it, I'm just...
Assisted.
And so they call it euthanasia with animals.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. And I think, you know, we have a lot of pet owners, right? And when Old Yeller, you know, just isn't what he used to be, right? Or Cujo is like, you know, doing his thing, right? You put him to death. Or, you know, you have assisted... it's not suicide because... We don't know what the dogs want, right? So I think the other thing that makes this very complicated too is there can be some moral ambiguity where you have end-of-life decisions, right? Like you have somebody who is unconscious and on a feeding tube. If you pull the feeding tube, they will certainly die, right? Is that ethical to do or not? Is that euthanasia? Are you causing somebody's death? And so what we're going to do today is we're going to kind of sort through some of those issues. And this is something where, especially when you make end-of-life decisions, like do you continue treatment? Do you withhold treatment? At what point do you cross over into killing someone versus letting them die? Right? At what point is it suicide versus not suicide? And that's why it's not always doctor-assisted suicide. Pulling the feeding tube on somebody who's unconscious, that's not a choice that they necessarily make. So we're going to talk a little bit about some categories to kind of help clarify the issue, okay? So this is a little bit technical. So we're going to look at some terminology, right? So euthanasia comes from good death. And so you have kind of three categories here. You have, I'll actually use the whiteboard. So you have voluntary, non-voluntary, and voluntary, involuntary, and non-voluntary, okay? This is, what is the will of the patient, okay? So the will of the patient, does the patient want to die, right? So voluntary, the will is, yes, the patient wants to die. Involuntary is the patient doesn't want to die. And then the non-voluntary is you don't really know what the wishes of the patient are. So if somebody is unconscious and doesn't have a living will, do they want it? We don't know, right? So a lot of times in these court cases, you know, they'll bring up this patient, this person had conversations with friends that if I'm ever in a vegetative state, go ahead and take my life. They try to resolve it that way, okay? So you have voluntary, involuntary, and non-voluntary. Then you have kind of the means of it, where is it active or passive, right? So what kind of action is taken to cause the death? And so if you give a lethal dose of drugs, right, that would be active, that is active euthanasia. If you pull a feeding tube, right, that would be passive because you're letting the person die by withholding something versus giving them something. Does that make sense? And then you have direct and indirect, and this is the, you know, the involvement. Like Jack Kevorkian, the suicide doctor, would actually hook somebody up to a suicide machine, and all you had to do was push the button, right? So that person had direct involvement. Whereas in Million Dollar Baby, the Clint Eastwood character came in and he was the one who basically injected the lethal drugs to cause the death, you know, of the Hilary Swank character, okay? So you kind of have like the will of the patient, the means by which it's done, and the involvement of a third party, or how involved is the person in the suicide process? Do they cause it to happen? So you can have somebody who wants to die, right? Wants it withheld, but because they're, let's say, a quadriplegic, they're unable to take measures themselves, it has to be assisted. Okay, so, and these all kind of create different ethical dilemmas, depending on what you do and when, right? So we would say, if somebody doesn't want to die, and the patient and these other people involved say, well, we're going to still pull your feeding tube, and since you can't stop us, we're going to do it anyway. Would that be right or wrong? It'd be wrong, right? Because the person doesn't want to die, right? If the person does want to die, and you have the means of, of assisting them in some way, right, like giving them lethal drugs, and then they take it, was it right to give them those drugs? Right? Or you get into, and I think the real questionable part is pulling a feeding tube, is that ever morally permissible? Because you're allowing somebody to die. Or if somebody has technology to extend a life, are they obligated to take it? Right, like let's say you have somebody who is suicidal and then he gets some infection and the doctor says if you take penicillin, the infection will go away, but he decides that he wants to die anyway, so he just won't take the penicillin. Was he morally obligated to take it in that case? You see what I'm saying? So you kind of get into this line of what's the difference between active, like actively killing someone we'd say is always wrong, But at what point is it wrong to not take measures that would otherwise save your life? Okay? So we'll look at the case for euthanasia in all circumstances. The first one is they talk about the quality of life. The mere fact that something has biological life, says one proponent, whether human or non-human, is relatively unimportant from an ethical point of view. What is important is that someone has biographical life. One's biographical life is the sum of one's aspirations, decisions, activities, projects, and human relationships. The facts of a person's biological life or biographical life are those of that person's history and character. They are the interests that are important and worthwhile from the point of view of the person himself or herself. The value of one's biographical life is the value it has for that person, and something has value if it's lost would harm that person. Okay, so what do you think about that reasoning? That what gives somebody's life value, it's its biographical content.
That's not what the Bible says.
Okay. Right?
God gives life, gives value to life.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's actually really shocking how like easy it is for people to get this. Like, I have a friend that has a very serious mental condition.
Yeah.
And she ended up being hospitalized for it, and they offered her this. And she was like, I don't want that.
They offered her?
Yes.
Wow.
And it's like a personality disorder, and they offered her that. And she was like, that's not why I'm here. But it's insane how almost easy it is to get that. It's almost like they're not really wanting to help. They're just wanting to end it and calling it helping.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. You see where that goes, right? If you don't think your life has meaning, then there's really no point in going on, right? Yeah, that's interesting. I'm surprised that happens here in the U.S., but that's kind of where it goes, right? Another one would be utilitarian concerns. An early death can be good for society. For instance, a cash-strapped family will not be forced to go into poverty with medical expenses so that they may postpone the inevitable. So what's the danger of this line of reasoning?
It's the good of the family.
Yeah.
So that's, you're putting value on certain things that is not all equal, I guess.
Yeah.
They're not trusting God to provide for them.
Uh-huh. Yep. What do you think? For the good of the family, for the good of society. Yeah.
They're completely lessening the value of someone just because they don't have as much money.
Mm-hmm.
It's like money is the value in the person.
Uh-huh. Yeah, other thoughts?
Do you think it makes a society less compassionate?
But what do you think?
Because they're not willing to sacrifice for people that maybe have a mental disability, Down syndrome, autistic. You're not willing to sacrifice for that, then you can become more, I don't know, a little bit more harsh.
Mm-hmm.
Less compassionate.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think too the standard of what it is to be useful is very subjective on culture as well. You can see there's at what point does a person become a burden or unuseful, and it's a pretty risky to have a broader a voice that changes based on whims, cultural whims.
Yeah.
I think of the long term, like if you're responsible for, you make a choice for the death of a family member.
Uh-huh.
How does the family deal with that long term?
Mm-hmm.
The guilt, how does it then long term affect how your family interact?
Yeah. Yeah, I think this even can make like a financial decision, right? If you have, if you have, let's say, a socialized medical system, where to be solvent, you need to make financial choices, right? And keeping somebody alive at the end of life when they require a lot of medical assistance is very expensive, right? So theoretically, you can have a situation is, I tell you what, we'll give your family $10,000 if you take these pills right now. Because you're going to save us 10 times as much by doing that. Right? You can almost incentivize death and even send the message that your life is a liability. And that's with like physical death, right? But then you get people with, let's say, mental illness, like you brought up, right? And what's the last thing that they need to hear?
You're a burden.
Mm-hmm. You're a burden?
You have no value.
Mm-hmm.
It would actually be helpful if you weren't here.
Yeah. You know, what probably keeps, and what keeps many of those people away from suicide? I would imagine the pain of suicide, right? So if you're to say, we're going to offer you a pain-free way to die, it's just like you're going to fall asleep, and then your life will end, and all of this will be over, right? You know, that is a very scary society where people start getting euthanized, and somebody who is mentally unstable can be talked into it pretty easily, right? And you start, yeah, go ahead.
That is why Switzerland is, I mean, that's kind of where a lot of it started, was a socialized country with socialized medicine.
Yeah, yeah.
It was very financial.
Yeah, and so when you get into a situation where society determines what life is worth living, as opposed to God determines what life is worth living, it's a very Orwellian future. So, yeah, so that'd be one thing to bring up, but the utilitarian concerns, and you're going to hear more of that later on as we look at the expense of keeping all these people alive. Then you have freedom of choice. It is wrong to impose our view of life and death upon someone else. Removing choices regarding the end of life is dehumanizing. In addition, euthanasia is not murder if the victim desires for his or her life to be taken. This is similar to the act of theft. The very notion of stealing involves the victim's desire that his possessions not be taken. Thus, if you want to take $100 of mine and you take it whether I'm looking or not, it is dubious that I could rightly accuse you of stealing. Stealing is wrong not just because someone takes something that is not theirs, but because permission is not granted to take it. If I grant permission to take something of mine, that is a gift, that is gift-giving, not theft. So, what does this view suggest about the humanity of infants, comatose patients, etc.?
When their lives are taken, their lives are stolen.
Mm-hmm. But you took up like freedom of choice, right? That freedom of choice is what makes somebody human.
You can't choose. They're not human.
Yeah, they can't choose. Yeah, so little Ryle back there, I mean, could he choose? Right? I mean, he doesn't. He's not conscious enough to know.
And they're unaware.
And they're unaware. Awareness. Yeah, they don't know. They can't process the information to even make a choice. Or know what's being put in front of them. Right? So, with children and stuff like that, their choices are easily manipulated. People who are mentally handicapped, their choices are easily manipulated. So is theft an appropriate analogy for euthanasia? For instance, is the act of murder negated when the victim requests to die? Why or why not?
Okay. Because if you get something stolen, like somebody steals from you, and mm-hmm. then say you call the cops, and they end up finding it, like say somebody, like Leona stole my car.
Mm-hmm.
Like just say you stole my car, I call the cops, and then they find it, they're going to return it to me. Whereas
mm-hmm.
when you request that, I guess, you're not going to get your life back.
Okay, it's irreversible.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's good. Next one.
Yeah, I mean, simple term is our lives are not our own.
Yeah.
So my life belongs to God, so I have ultimate say, choice over what I do with a life that belongs to Him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We also, this is sort of a pretty radically individualistic perspective as well. So even outside of my life belonging to God, there is a sense in which my life is deeply tied into my family and my society, the people around me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not an individual island.
Yeah.
Makes choices without regard to mm-hmm. others. In that sense, we belong to one another as well.
Uh-huh.
And this is tricky because I think legally I would actually agree that theft is in some way an appropriate analogy for euthanasia. From a purely legal perspective, and my opinion mm-hmm. does not reflect on my employer or Harvest Legal in general. Please don't assume Chris believes the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd say if you consent to have your life taken, then at least from a legal perspective, it would resolve the issue of having your life taken from you undesirably. The problem is we don't know what people think in their last seconds.
Well, so there's this place in Mexico, these Mayan ruins, Chichen Itza, I'm not sure what you call it, but I remember I went there on vacation with my family when we were young, and there was this big courtyard, and there were these stone hoops that were kind of on their side. Do you know what I'm talking about? And the game was you had a little ball, and you had to hit the ball through the hoop. And if you win the game, do you know what the reward is? The captain of the winning team gets to be sacrificed.
And it was the whole team.
Was it the whole team?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, look at the whole team gets to be sacrificed, right? Is that murder?
Yeah.
Is that murder? They want to be sacrificed. Hey, guess what? We get to be sacrificed.
Well, from a moral, spiritual perspective, yes. And
yep.
I'm not saying that euthanasia isn't wrong.
Yep.
I'm saying from a purely worldly, legal perspective, I think there's a very plain case to be made. That's why we don't address it from just a legal perspective or
mm-hmm.
just a worldly perspective. It's why we need specifically a God-driven perspective in this,
mm-hmm.
because if we look at it from purely legal morality or worldly morality, then yeah, there's it fits within the categories of when it's no longer murder.
Well, technically, I mean, murder is the illegal taking of a human life. And so if you know, somebody offers their body to be sacrificed in some like weird ritual cult in the U.S. That's still an act of murder, even if the person willingly did it for religious reasons. Right? They would be prosecuted for murder because it's the illegal taking of a human life.
I'm not completely. I know things like cannibalism are actually legal if done through the right legal procedures.
I'm going to have to get some sources on that. I'll have to get some sources on that. But from a biblical perspective, at least, right, it's not your life to take, right? Just like, you can't just go around killing people and just say, well, they wanted it.
That sounds creepy.
Doesn't it?
Yeah, it's gross.
Yeah, and so when we look at what makes suicide wrong, right, suicide is self-murder. Right, it's not your life to take, okay? And I want to give you, actually we got one more, and then I'm going to give you some biblical arguments here, okay? The other one is euthanasia is a demonstration of mercy. It is wrong to call upon someone to prolong their suffering when death can end the pain. I have a note here that I'm going to read. Okay. Pardon me. So note, murder involves the intentional taking of the innocent life of someone made in God's image. If that is the definition of murder, obviously murder can be committed whether the victim has to be killed or not. Murder, unlike stealing, can be committed with or without the victim's permission. Thus, voluntary and involuntary distinction matters in the way suggested to some acts like theft, but not to other acts like murder. Okay. So demonstration of murder is wrong to call upon someone to prolong their suffering when death can end their pain. So what do you think about that? It's wrong to call people to keep on suffering. Biblically, how would you answer that?
So
suffering has purpose.
Mm-hmm.
All over scripture.
Yep. Yeah, what else?
If they're not a believer, this is the most ironic argument
you
can make.
Yeah. So what would you say to somebody who says, you're just imposing your religion on us by talking about heaven and hell?
Well, yeah.
Yeah. Guilty, right?
And
yeah.
You're going to have it imposed on your eternity one way or another eventually.
Yeah. Yeah, other ways you might answer that?
What do you think will happen when you die? Just
yeah.
Float around in the void?
Yeah, that's also a religious, you know, assertion, right? Assertion, right?
Is there a difference between taking steps to prolong life and taking steps to end life? So, like, for instance, if someone has cancer and they've taken treatments for years and it's essentially ruined their life health-wise, should they continue taking steps to prolong life? Or, like, obviously, if they didn't, they'd be taking steps to end their life.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that.
Okay.
So there's a difference between actively killing and letting someone die.
Okay.
Okay. So that's a very key ethical distinction. But as it stands, we're going to just look at like active euthanasia because I think that's the most clear-cut distinction. So let's turn to, let's go to 2 Samuel. I want to qualify this a little bit. Now, we know from the end of 1 Samuel that King Saul was mortally wounded and he did not want to be captured by his enemies, and so he fell on his sword and took his own life. Okay, so he committed suicide. Now in this passage, a young man from the Amalekites came and approaches David. Okay, so this is David is working with the knowledge that he's been given. And we'll start in 2 Samuel chapter 1, verse 4. And David said, "How did it go? Tell me." And he answered, "The people fled from the battle, and also many of the people have fallen and are dead. And Saul and his son Jonathan are also dead." Then David said to the young man who told him, "How do you know that Saul and his son Jonathan are dead?" The young man who told him said, "By chance I happened to be on Mount Gilboa, and there was Saul leaning on his spear, and behold, the chariots and the horsemen were close upon him. And when he looked behind him, he saw me and called to me, and he answered, 'Here I am.' And he said to me, 'Who are you?' And I answered him, 'I am an Amalekite.' And he said to me, 'Stand beside me and kill me, for anguish has seized me, and yet my life still lingers.'" Right? So he's basically called. This is a call for active euthanasia. And this is not actually what happened, but this is what is being told to David. "So I stood beside him and killed him, because I was sure that he could not live after he had fallen." So his life was wasting away. I went ahead and ended it. "And I took the crown that was on his head and the armlet that was on his arm, and I have brought them to my lord." And David took hold of his clothes, and he tore them, and so did all the men who were with him. And they mourned, wept, fasted from evening for Saul and for Jonathan his son and for the people of the Lord, for the house of Israel, because they have fallen by the sword. And David said to the young man who told him, "Where did he come from?" And he answered, "I'm the son of a sojourner, an Amalekite." And David said to him, "How is it that you are not afraid to put your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed?" Then David called one of the young men and said, "Go execute him." And he struck him down so that he died. Right? So David does not see taking Saul's life as a good thing, even though he is in anguish and dying and Saul requested it, right? You know, this would be an example of a judgment on somebody who claims to have committed euthanasia. Okay, so I think that's, one theologian kind of brought that up. I thought that's a pretty interesting argument, kind of describing what happened, mortally wounded, not killing somebody. That's very different from giving him comfort so that he dies relatively peacefully. Okay, so we'll look at the Christian response. One is the sanctity of human life. As we discussed, God created life and presides over when it begins and ends. Two, the value of suffering. Life does not lose its meaning when it loses biographical value. God can bring meaning to any life through his providential oversight. Through suffering, though suffering is neither enjoyable nor to be sought, that does not mean that it cannot have a positive impact on a person's life. While afflictions are evil, God does use them to work good in our lives, as the following verses in the book of Job testify. Can you think of any famous examples of people who've suffered greatly in a diminished capacity? Yeah.
Joni Tada.
Yeah. Yeah, Joni Erickson Tada. Do you guys know her story? She was a kind of a popular girl in high school athlete, and she ended up diving off a raft in the Chesapeake Bay and became a quadriplegic. And kind of through that became a Christian and has a pretty vibrant ministry, ministering to people who have physical disabilities. So that would be a good example. You guys have Eddie? And in fact, she learned how to hold a paintbrush with her teeth, and she would paint pictures and write books, and pretty remarkable woman.
So. But she still suffers terribly with
yeah.
it. Yeah. Painfully.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she has phantom pains now.
Yeah, she's got cancer on top of it.
Yeah. So she has suffered. She was actually your high school principal's wife, right?
My history teacher.
Yeah. Yeah. Lives in Burbank, California. There you go. Okay, other famous people you can think of? That's the one that came to my mind, but.
Well, our president.
Yeah.
He would not be seen in public under certain circumstances because he suffered from MS.
Mm-hmm.
And he suffered terribly.
Mm-hmm. FDR? Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This gentleman, I don't remember his name, but he was born without like all his appendages.
Mm-hmm.
Just he had only his body and his head, I believe.
Yeah.
Nick Ross.
The
yeah.
Nick part sounds right. I don't know about the.
Yeah, I know who you're talking about. Yeah, and I even think about. What it says about a community or a family who takes care of somebody who is suffering, right? There's, I think what Joshua brought up is it's more than just an individual decision. It's the impact on the community, right? Like I look at, I think Iceland, they have successfully eradicated all people with Down syndrome, right? You won't find anybody with Down syndrome in Iceland. They had them all aborted. So Special Olympics is actually beginning to be greatly diminished, where they don't have enough Down syndrome children to kind of make it happen anymore. And I think, you know, what does that say about our society? And if you've known people who have Down syndrome siblings or children, you know, there is something that it just brings out a lot of goodness in them. Does that make sense? So there is value for suffering, even diminished people, not just for the individual themselves, but also for the community who bears the burdens. Okay, other thoughts on that?
I think it's interesting that everybody's really happy and willing to stamp, you know, we support Special Olympics.
Uh-huh.
But a lot of these same people, at least the people who I've had conversations with outside of organizations, just people in general who are all for the Special Olympics, are also all for euthanizing people who have, you know, deeper struggles when it comes to disabilities, deeper struggles when it comes to their physical or mental capacities. And it just seems particularly two-faced to me.
Mm-hmm.
Where they'll say whatever seems culturally appropriate,
mm-hmm.
but they also support the death of
mm-hmm.
anybody who might participate.
Yeah, Joshua?
A lot of stuff we were talking about are sort of things you're born with that are forever, but much of suffering in life is from family tragedy, from
mm-hmm.
cancer, from period of dark night of the soul.
Yeah.
Those are all real sufferings as well, and I think most of us can point to times of suffering that in the end God used to bring greater sense of maturity, greater dependency,
yeah,
different kind of joy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think often we focus on the suffering of the child, for instance,
mm-hmm.
Going back to children with Down syndrome and autism and things like that, we focus on oh, they're going to have such a struggle. They're just going to have the worst of it.
Mm-hmm.
But these kids are often the ones that are they know the secret of life. They are constantly happy.
Yeah.
They're just joyful. And
yeah.
We don't focus on that. And
they're pretty happy kids.
Yeah, they are happy. They also are the ones that strive the most to make it. So it's just
sad. Yeah, and I think I was listening to a podcast, I think I might have shared this earlier, about how we live in an age of anxiety right now, where a lot of young people struggle with anxiety. And part of it is this belief, because of therapy, right? The purpose of therapy is to do what? Help people feel better, right? And so it's almost like happiness needs to be your default emotion. And if you're anxious because you're not happy, I think I'm a pretty happy guy. I wasn't happy yesterday watching the J-Pop game. But I was happy after the Super Bowl. Sorry, Josh, but it's meaningful for me. But if happiness is your default emotion and you should always be happy, then you're taught that something's wrong with you if you're not. I mean, where does that lead? Right? And so people, when you kind of have to define your own meaning and your internal compass is, if it makes me happy, then this is what it should be, as opposed to, I think, having this higher purpose, this narrative, this story that's being written by the author of life, it can be a very meaningful life in the midst of a lot of suffering. Right? So I think losing the value of suffering as a society, it's if you're suffering, your life is no good. There's no higher purpose for it. And most religions are really built around the idea that life is suffering. How do you make sense and how do you have meaning in a world where there's dying and suffering, disease, and things seem to go wrong, right? And one of the great things about childhood is they don't have to deal with those burdens, right? As you get older, you get more in touch with the curse. So yeah, there's value in suffering. God's will for your life is not that you're happy all the time. That's for heaven, right? That you're holy and God uses the suffering for your good. There's purpose behind it. And often, right, suffering is what the Lord uses to bring people to him, to remind them that things are not what it should be. And so if the goal of suffering is to turn you away from him, right, to commit suicide and to end your life, you're kind of missing the larger point.
Well, and also just understanding that suffering is part of our sanctification. And we're, as a family, kind of dealing with this with a handicapped child now.
Mm-hmm.
And Philippians 2 is where we are living, my daughter and I.
Yeah.
And I'm going to read it to three. Do nothing from selfish ambition or conceit, but in humility count others more significant than yourself.
Yeah.
And that is what we've been called to. And it really takes your focus off yourself and wanting everything to be perfect. And there is purpose, and we are being sanctified through a life that is not perfect.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's a reminder that there is something wrong with this world.
Yes.
I mean, if everything broke our way, then there wouldn't be a longing for the world to come. But yeah, that's a good perspective.
I think it's hard for unbelievers, though, where we live in a cultural world where God is love,
mm-hmm.
and only love,
mm-hmm.
to think that something that is hard is good.
Yeah.
We don't do hard things, we don't want to do hard things, and God is love, so why would you put us through this? Right.
Yeah.
And heart can look different for everyone. Like Joshua said, there's all different types of suffering. But I think specifically in the culture we're living in, it's extra hard for unbelievers who have this wrong view of God. They don't have a complete view of their creator.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and one question that really all religions try to answer is, why is there evil and why is there suffering, why is there pain? We don't pretend like it's not there. It is there, but it's there for a good purpose, ultimately. And yeah, there's value in that. And when you just try to shortcut suffering, end suffering, suffering makes things worthless, that goes all kinds of bad places, as we're going to talk about the slippery slope. Now, one might want to limit the breadth of the category of people who qualify for euthanasia, but once it is decided that certain people are to die, it is hard to find any logical grounds for keeping others alive. For example, if the category includes those lacking the dignity of human beings, this can include many not terminally ill, not in pain, nor desirous of death. They may simply fail to meet some ambiguous standard of what it means to be human. Historically, this is supported by the Nazis, who began mercy killing in limited cases to relieve suffering, but the practice exploded into genocide. Proponents of euthanasia invariably guarantee that it will be used only in rather narrowly defined cases. The wedge argument says there is no logical or easily agreed upon reason why the range of cases should be restricted. For instance, why stop at terminally ill? Why not extend it to profoundly unhappy people, Down syndrome children, crippled adults, etc.? Once you go down the slope of euthanasia, what stops you from going all the way down? Right? And I mean, as Liana kind of pointed out, if somebody is mentally ill, right? And I think there is, even in our day and age, where there's this equivocation between physical suffering and mental suffering, that both are just as bad, just as real. And, you know, if you're mentally ill, then maybe the solution for you is to take your own life and we'll help you do it. And that's a very dangerous argument or suggestion to make to mentally ill people. Okay, any thoughts on that?
I think it's also especially dangerous when the definition of what being mentally ill is very broad, mm-hmm. and there's over-diagnosing of certain things like depression, things like that, with kids who, may not actually have it, but they've been clinically diagnosed with it.
Mm-hmm.
So that makes the slippery slope even more slippery.
Yeah.
It's not just the slippery slope, there's already cases popping up of instances where it's been forcibly administered.
Mm-hmm.
I think this was in 2016, but it was in Switzerland, where an older woman with dementia, her family was literally ordered to restrain her while a doctor administered a lethal drug.
Yeah.
Instances of drugs being slipped into coffee or tea with older patients, especially with dementia,
yeah.
has also been popped up.
Mm-hmm.
It's already kind of happening.
Yeah.
And I think when you live in a world, especially I think for our generation,
mm-hmm.
and maybe Generation Alpha, there's this like glorification and weakness where who you are and how special you are is defined by like how depressed you are.
Mm-hmm.
And so it becomes a competition. I'm sadder than you are. I'm weaker. I've suffered more than you have. Therefore, I'm more valuable and my voice is more important. And it becomes this really strange system where we encourage each other further, closer to you know, the brink
uh-huh.
of this bridge, of this figurative, imaginary
mm-hmm.
bridge.
Mm-hmm.
And we're just like, we're consistently pushing each other closer and closer to just jumping off. Because if we're encouraged to die
mm-hmm.
when we're sad, if that's a solution,
yeah.
And then our entire system operates on, you're more valuable the sadder and more depressed you are, the more you struggle, the
mm-hmm.
better of a person you are, the more valuable of a person you are. I mean, the causal link is obvious.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think when you have a society that you know, treat mentally ill people, special needs people as liabilities. That you are actually a drag to society, you're pulling society down, so we'd be better off without you. As opposed to a society that celebrates all life, like, you know, God has given you this child for a purpose. You know, there's a greater purpose for you, your family, and this community. We are going to be better off because you are present, right? Even people with dementia, you know, caregiving for people who, and we've all heard, you know, heard of those beautiful stories of the husband or the wife caregiving, you know, for their spouse who's greatly diminished to the end of their life, right? Those are just beautiful stories about love and faithfulness. There's moral teaching in them. You know, the community really sets a value on life and on suffering, and maybe that person doesn't positively and actively give to the community, but God has placed them in the community to bring out the best in the community. Does that make sense? So when society begins to treat the weak and the infirmed as disposable, which was really the Nazi ideology, right? It was about making people pure and strong, breeding the right people, and getting rid of those who had inferior genes, at least all kinds of unspeakable evils, right? And then you have medical concerns. At what point do you determine that someone is terminally ill? History is filled with cures for incurable diseases, and as medicine progresses, the deceased has no hope of benefiting from the advances. Further, an agonizing death may be overstated, as new medicines can greatly reduce pain to a bearable level. So, and we're going to get into this question, is that at what point do you say somebody really is terminally ill? And what used to make, you know, what used to be a terminal diagnosis may not be that anymore, right? So with what certainty can we say that active euthanasia is morally wrong? That is, taking active steps to take someone's life, and the steps that you take, the end is death itself. It's not letting them die, but actively taking their life. But what certainty can we say that it's wrong? It's murder. Even if the person wants it, right? It is irreversible. They can't make a comeback. They're taking a life that's not theirs to take. So we'll go ahead and kind of pause here, because I think the exceptions, this is the part where it's really important, I think, that everybody kind of has a good sense of, you know, when do you quote unquote pull the plug? You know, when do you get doctor's permission to do that? It's a very important discussion that we're going to have, not next week, because we're going to, it's Easter, so there'll be kind of a, what do you call it, a semi brunch?
A coffee
with pastries.
A mild feast.
A mild feast.
As my kids call it, dessert.
Dessert, we're going to have dessert for breakfast.
Or dessert of their breakfast.
Yes, we're going to do that next week. And then the week after, we'll get into end-of-life decisions. And this is a super, I would encourage you guys to come, think about it, come with your questions. These are real issues that I've had to walk many people through. And so I'm really glad that I had some firm understanding of these issues beforehand. But any other thoughts before we go? Yeah.
So, because I'm older,
uh-huh,
and I have seen such an evolution, my first two jobs were in Catholic hospitals.
Yeah.
And to see the progression, and it is a downward progression,
uh-huh,
of going from a strictly Christian care model, and it was, I mean, they were Catholic, but it was Christian.
Yeah.
And just their focus on life, and making people comfortable, and caring for not just their body, but their soul.
Yeah.
To the last breath. To now this very secular, they're in pain. Oh my goodness. Now let's, in general, a lot of physicians playing God. So you go in kind of a godless situation where they are now in the position of authority, and over a person's life. And there's just no consideration for morals or for value of life. It has been a very sad thing to watch. And even in Catholic, so they are now very corporate, very money-oriented.
Yeah.
The change is dramatic.
Yeah. So. Yeah.
And I think you can consider the medical like side of it all you want, but at the end of the day, there's still the will of God. And so there's been a lot of instances where people are like deemed terminal, and then there's a miraculous recovery.
Yeah.
Like we hear about that all the time.
Yeah.
And so to take the means to kill yourself, you know, there's that like fine line between like, well, what would, obviously it was the Lord's will, but there, you know, like you don't know what his plan is.
Yeah.
In your suffering, ultimately.
Yeah.
It could be death, but it could also not be.
Yeah. So active euthanasia is always wrong. I think what we're going to talk about next time is, what about passive? Is it, when do you stop the respirator? When do you stop, do you insert a feeding tube? When do you kind of do the next surgery? Do you have to continue with chemotherapy? Those are the questions that we're going to get into. And those are very difficult decisions that all of us, you know, is it euthanasia to say, I don't want to go through chemotherapy? You know, is that suicide, or is that letting the disease run its course? So we're going to talk about some of those things next week. So let me pray, and then I'll let you guys go. Or 2 weeks, sorry. Well, Father, I do thank you just for life that you've given us, and I pray that all of us will walk away knowing that all life is a gift from you, that even in the midst of suffering, you have a plan for us. And I pray that we will be a community that celebrates life, that celebrates all life, regardless of weakness and sickness and handicap and disabilities. Pray for the rest of this day that it'll be a real uplifting time as we talk about, you know, learn about you, sing to you, and honor you with our fellowship and our rejoicing and praise. In Christ's name, amen.